Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you, and we have a full house in here. And we have a bunch of bassists in here tonight. My guest is Richard Roos from Trickfish Amps. I had met him over at the NAMM show, but other people had kept coming up, and you got to check these amps out. So it was kind of a mutual thing. And I knew I had to have him on the show. These amps sound so great. And they're, he actually brought in a prototype speaker, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But let me introduce everybody that's in the room right now besides Richard. Richard, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Great to be here.
And Richard, everybody here plays bass. So Richard's a professional bassist, but he also, his background was with SWR Engineering, KRK Systems, and JBL Professional. And he put together Trickfish Amps, and as a bassist, built an amp that he felt needed to be done because as a bassist, he wasn't getting what he wanted from the other amps that were out on the market. Also in studio, the roster, Tim Landers is another great studio bassist and sideman. He's played with some of my favorites. I'm just going to go briefly through this list of billions of people. Al DiMeola, Billy Cobham, Michael Brecker, Dave Grusin, Lee Ritenour, Tracy Chapman, Tom Scott, The Crusaders, Al Stewart, and it goes on and on and on. Welcome to the show. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And as my guest host, which actually turned out to be two guest hosts because they are inseparable and they're great people, some of my best friends for years, Lisa Carbe, another bass player and part of Carbe Durand, and JP Durand from Carbe Durand. So both of them play bass besides guitars. So it's everybody, and everybody brought a bass. So Lisa brought her Michael Tobias, which we showed on a previous show, which is just a killer sounding bass. And Tim has an upright, electric upright, that's just very cool. And I brought with me an acoustic bass because this new speaker was designed for acoustic bass. This is the Boulder Creek that I have, the Koa. So we have a little bit of everything here. We're going to test all of them through this new speaker and go through this great little amp. It's small, but it's got a lot of power. Anyway, first of all, let me start off with Richard and give a little bit of your background so that we can get an idea how this all came about and where you're coming from.
Well, you know, I'm like a lot of people that, you know, saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. Mm-hmm. And I was more interested in how my sisters were reacting to it than maybe the music. I have three older sisters. No, you know, from age 11, I started playing bass. I'd say when I was about 21, well, let's say 18, I met Scott Henderson, the great mm-hmm. guitarist. We had a band in Toledo, Ohio. We were doing Gentle Giant and Chick Corea tunes and crazy stuff and getting fired on a weekly basis for trying to play that live in bars. and eventually that ended up becoming a ZZ Top band where we played all of our crazy odd time originals in the first set when no one would dance. And we told them, you're not going to be able to dance to this, but you're going to just listen to it and love it. And then we played without, you know, a blink of an eye, the best ZZ Top and, you know, Fog Hat covers you ever heard. And moved to Boston. A friend of mine, a drummer, Mike Radovsky, was living there in a big house with all these musicians. And I get there on a Wednesday night. I walk in. Mike's not there. So it's a house full of strangers that I'm moving into. And, you know, I'm coming from Toledo, Ohio to Boston. Boston's the big city, you know. And the first guy I meet sitting in front of the stereo with headphones on, and he goes, oh, hey, this is a tape of me playing with Herbie Hancock. Mm-hmm, and I'm thinking, yeah, okay, sure. I said, okay, these guys are, you know, this guy might be nuts. And he unplugs the headphones, and we're listening to the track. And I'm going, man, that piano, it sounds just like Herbie Hancock, and the drums are insane, and the bass player's lost, you know? And he goes, yeah, this happened. I called him up on the phone out there, told him I was a drummer and that I wanted to play with him. Well, that guy turned out to be Vinnie Colaiuta.
Mm-hmm.
Kermit Driscoll, the great bassist who lives in New York, who spent, I don't know, Tim, what was it, 10 or 12 years playing with Bill Frisell?
Yeah.
Yeah, a long time. And mm-hmm. played with Buddy Rich and has great Buddy Rich stories. But Kermit was living in the house, and Kermit had studied with Jaco, and it's the primary reason I moved there was to study with Kermit and to go to school. I was going to probably end up going to Berkeley. So the first Sunday, they had a jam room in the house. And there's all these guys that come over to play. And Vinny's playing drums. And Kermit's playing bass. And Tiger Okoshi's playing trumpet. And Mike Stern's playing guitar. And God knows who else was there. And I'm sitting on the couch listening to this and going, I better load up my station wagon and go back to Ohio. Because if this is what's going on, if these are the everyday musicians in Boston, forget it.
Yeah,
I'm done.
Well, you waltzed into a particular hornet's nest of greatness there.
Well, yeah, that's what it was, right? I mean, and Tim was one of the guys that used to come by the house.
This was a famous house, by the way. This place that Richard's talking about, that he lived, where he lived, everybody at school at Berkeley at the time, this is late 70s, everybody knew about this house because everybody went through there. It was one of these places. It was a transient place where all these students went in and out. And just for some reason, it attracted some of the best musicians ever. Just happened to go through this one house. So I can imagine what you must have thought when you get there. Well, this is the way it is everywhere. Forget about it.
Yeah, exactly. Then I came to understand that these were the very best guys in Boston. And, you know, understood how fortunate I was. Spent several years in Boston studying privately, playing out, which was at the advice of some of these guys that came over. Dad, don't go to Berkeley. Just, you know, study privately and go out and gig, because that's where you're really going to learn how to play, you know. And at that time, my rig was, and I'll tell you a quick funny story about it. An Alembic F2B with it might have been an Ashley, but it was probably, could have been a Tapco graphic equalizer and a Crown power amp, a DC 300A, I think it was. And I had a little EV Eliminator cabinet and a double 15 custom tuck and roll.
That was a nice.
Did you use the Tapco as your preamp?
I saw that.
No, I used the F2B.
That was nice.
Oh, so the
Alembic was a stereo F2B. Preamp.
Oh, that's a preamp. Okay. Yeah, what was your bass?
My bass was, and this just a little tear will come to my eye. It was a 58 Precision that I paid $175 for.
Oh.
See, wow. Look at that, everybody's.
And what happened to it?
So you got to put it into context.
Sold it.
At the time, Stanley, this is 1977. So Stanley was out. All these new interesting basses were coming out. A 58 Precision in 1977 was only 19 years old. And people weren't collecting vintage instruments.
Yeah.
And the sound, and this will, and I'll parlay this into, you know, what's going on here.
Yeah.
The sounds that we were listening to, you know, the guys at Alembic, Rick Turner, you know, and come on.
I thought Alembic was
owner.
Yeah, I thought it was Rick Turner. He's looking at the
Well, face. So all these guys came from the Grateful Dead's camp.
Right.
And Stanley Owsley, or Owsley Stanley.
Stanley,
The guy who invented the wall of sound, put together this little group of guys, and you know, I can't remember, Ron Wickersham, and his wife Susan actually owned Alembic, right? And, you know, they created the first Lone Pines pickups, the Alembic bass, I have to say, was probably the first super high-end, full-range instrument out there. Stanley was probably in, what, 75 was playing one, or 74, maybe?
He switched from his jazz bass to
Me. I think Jack Cassidy and also...
All those guys were involved in it, right? Yeah. Owsley, by the way, made excellent acid back then. He was a chemist. And he made all the Grateful Dead's acid. I wouldn't know anything about that.
Yes.
But but high school only lasted 3 years for me.
Well, you remembered all those names, so you're not doing too bad.
Yeah.
It was good stuff.
It was good stuff. the Fender, I took it down to a music store down by Berkeley, traded it in, ended up getting an Alembic bass, another long story, and played the Alembic. And I also had an SD Curly bass at the time. You remember those
of
things?
Course, yeah.
Yeah. The shortest note known to man.
Yeah. Especially that D on the G string. Right?
Yeah, that, it was just...
lasted about a quarter of a second.
Yeah. And guys were playing Travis Beans. Kermit had a Travis Bean. You were working with Mike Padula.
Early on, yeah.
Yeah,
And he made me a Rosewood, all solid Rosewood bass.
Oh.
And there was a picture of me playing that bass up at Wurlitzer, the Wurlitzer Music Store, which is the big music store in Boston,
yeah,
right, on Newbury Street.
Yeah.
Right across from the studio that was eventually the Cars studio.
Yeah, but Interface Studio.
He took a black and white kind of silhouette photograph of me playing that bass, which kind of looked a little bit like an Alembic, the early...
Yeah, it did have that round body.
Because we were going for that. That's what I was also into. But it had big, fat DiMarzio humbuckers on it, and like a badass bridge, and you know, and where he set the bridge up in the body, it made the neck stick out a little bit longer too. So it kind of had an Alembic, you know, vibe to it.
But it was that modern. Yeah. It was that transition
was
from Fenders and Rickenbackers.
We didn't call them boutique basses then, but it was the beginning of that.
And the first true hi-fi basses, really.
Hi-fi. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Except that the Padulas weren't low impedance, and I wanted a low impedance bass. I wanted that Alembic, but.
The Alembic came with that little power supply, you know, the 5-pin connector on it. Yeah. And so that plugged into my F2B, which was serial number 412. And there's a guy here in L.A. that has it. Mm-hmm. I get back, Bill Hansen.
that was a great amp.
And he won't give it to me. But so one night, we get a call. And, hello, is Kermit there? No, he's doing a gig, you know. Because you only had one phone per house back then.
Right.
You know.
Kids,
it was a real phone.
Kids, take note.
You know.
No cell phones.
Yeah. He goes, well, this is Tim Landers. Something happened to my head, and I needed to borrow Kermit's amp. I said, well, Kermit's gone. You're welcome to come by and take my rig, you know. And... what did you do? You backed over.
I ran over it.
You ran over the head.
Yeah.
And didn't it get sucked up into the wheel well and pop the tire?
It just broke. I was living in New York by then, and I would come back to Boston to do gigs with like Tiger Okoshi or Stan Davis or whoever. And And I had like this some extra gear at my mom's house. I had an old PV Mark IV or something,
yeah.
You know, basically.
So it was a PV head. I remember that. Yeah.
And I was on my way into Boston. She lives south of Boston, about 20 miles. And I'm packing up her car, you know, going to borrow her car. And I put the cabinet in the back, and I forgot something. I ran back in the house and forgot that I had left the amp head behind the car, you know, and I'm in a hurry. So I get in the car and I just put it in reverse, and all of a sudden, you know, this.
We have to do a show on amp abuse. Yeah. It's a serious problem. Yeah.
There's a good one. So he comes.
That's
over.
What happened. So I called the house to try to get Kermit to get his amp, and that rig was fabulous. It was a really cool rig. It was the best rig.
He comes in and he's looking in the room, and he's going, "Well, where's your bass amp?" I said, "Well, that's it right there." And he goes, "That's a bass amp?"
Yeah.
Because it was all racked up, you know. You were playing at Pooh's Pub or something, right?
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
You took it down and then you brought it back, you know, 2 a.m. or whatever, and went, holy crap, you know. For me, I was always kind of a wing nut, you know, and that's what we call guys that are into gear, right?
You're
kind of a wing nut. And I had worked with a guy in Scott Henderson's band that was super technical. In fact, when that band broke up, he bought a van. He moved to San Francisco. He went to go work for this guy named Ray Dolby.
Mm-hmm.
And he's employee number 9 at Dolby Laboratories. His name's Brad Teague. And, you know, Brad, we used to call him Maha Brad New because he was a disciple of Sri Chin Moy. And he had a picture of Sri Chin Moy on his piano at the time. And
dressed in orange.
It was a black and white picture, so I'm not sure what he was wearing. We didn't have color pictures back then.
I met your friend.
Brad was an original hippie, and he got all of his hair cut off, and he had that Opie from Andy and Mayberry haircut, and he fixed TAC and Crown tape recorders and amplifiers and stuff, and you know. But that was something that Brad and I shared. And Scott Henderson is the second tweakiest guitar player I know. Buzzy Featon might be the first.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure they could give each other a run for the money. But, you know, that search for tone, that's what it was. I mean, that's what it comes down to. It's fun playing with gear, but it was all about trying to get things to sound as good as you can. And as a player, I was on that path my whole career, just trying to find that sound. And by the time I had left Boston, moved to Chicago, played there, ended up getting rid of the Tuck and Roll Double 15 and putting a JBL Cabaret cabinet up there. So now I had a full range 15-inch two-way, and it was the one with the little slot tweeter,
right.
Not the one with the
right.
horn. And an Eliminator cabinet that had an Altec driver in it, and still using the F2B and the Alembic, and now I had that full range sound, and this was going to be maybe 85, something like, no, it would have been 82, something like that, 83. And then Scott Henderson talked me into moving out to California. I got out here.
Mm-hmm.
I was playing professionally. I started doing a lot of very fun sessions, played with a lot of people everyone's heard of, and the money was goofy back in the 90s. Tim will attest to that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, got to experience an audio chain that would consist of a Neve module into an LA-2A or a 1176 compressor and possibly a GML EQ, and that's how you got into the UREI speakers, the 15s up in the soffits.
Mm-hmm.
And you're playing through that and you're going, okay, that's the tone. Mm-hmm. That's the sound right there.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with bass amplification was that it was trying to keep up with the advancement in not only the technology of electric basses, but also the consumer technology that was coming out in cars. In other words, when I was a kid,
mm-hmm.
you had the dashboard 6x9, you know, that,
mm-hmm.
that came with, you know, a 1962 Comet, you know. And by this time, they were sophisticated audio in cars, but everybody had a good home stereo. And so our ears were getting better at hearing music, audio, let's put it that way. I heard a great joke, a guy knew that he had come to California when he was at a gas station, and while he was in there, someone broke into his car and installed an 8-track tape recorder. anyways, so I was doing all these sessions, and I was working at Nadine's Music. I was in, I was a manager there, but I was also in charge of Pro Audio. And I sold all the bass stuff because no one else wanted to do it, and I was a bass player. And that worked out. It was fun, and it was a big hang. I mean, everybody came through, and Michelle and DiGiacello and Andrew Goucher and Ernest Tibbs and all these L.A.-based bass players would just come down to Nadine's and hang out, And there'd be days. Lisa, you probably popped in there back then.
Oh, yeah. I used to hang down there with you sometimes.
Yeah, that's right. We had great gear. And
I bought a 92 Made in Mexico jazz bass from you.
From me?
Well, from
From Nadine's?
From Nadine's. 92 Lake Placid Blue. And it was a Made in Mexico bass. It was one of the nicest P basses I ever had, by the way. But you had a bunch on the wall, I remember, and I went into Nadine's, and it was always really friendly there, and I just sat down. But Louis Johnson was there.
Louis Johnson used to work there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he remembers?
Yeah. Well, of course I do.
Yeah, so.
Quick, funny story about that. There's these two brothers sitting there in suits, probably on their lunch break, and I'm trying to sell them a $300 Yamaha P bass kind of thing, And they're hemming and hawing, and Louis comes out of the warehouse, and Louis was working there for legal reasons, he needed to work, and he asked Derek if he could work at Nadine's, and Derek said, really? Yeah, sure. He says, but you're going to have to work in the warehouse. Louis Johnson was the best warehouse guy that company ever had. The same thing he took to playing bass, he took to working in a warehouse. And he was a wonderful, warm human being. We loved him to death. He'd even show up at the meetings on Friday morning. I say morning at 9 o'clock, all of us were gigging and stuff, and so it was tough to be there at night.
Yeah, that's
it was brutal, And here's Louis, bright eyed and bushy tailed. So anyways, Louis comes popping out of the back, and I go, "Hey, Louis," and he's got his gloves on, with the fingers cut out, right? Mm-hmm. I go, "Louis, what do you think of this bass?" And he grabs it, and he just gets all Louis Johnson on it, right? He's tearing the strings off the thing, And he goes, "Yeah, Richard, that's a pretty good bass," and hands it back to me, and I hand it to the guy, and Louis walks away, and the guy goes, "Was that Louis Johnson?" And I go, "Yeah, he works here. I'll take it." it was just like that. It was that fast. I'll take it. The sessions were going, Nadine's was going, and I saw over a fax machine, there was the Alesis rep had was gone, and they were looking for someone new. And so I thought, I got a baby coming, and, the session thing is going good, but it's not really consistent. For me, it wasn't. I'm not Nathan East. I'm not Tim Landers. I'm not any of those guys. And so I went down there and talked to them and got the gig. And that's how I got into the supply side of the business. From there, I spent 5 years or so at Alesis, and then called Daryl from SWR and said, "Look, I've been all over the country, and you've got problems out there with dealers, and I can help you with this, And Daryl hired me at SWR, and we developed a bunch of new products, the Moog Bass, the Megaliath, the Bass 750, a couple of other pieces. And we grew the business from where it was when Daryl bought it, from Steve Robbie, who is still working there, by the way. Mm-hmm. Daryl and Steve had known each other for years. Between Daryl and I and the things we identified we could change, from an operations and a business point of view. You know, we doubled the size of the company. It got big enough to sell to Fender. I left there, went to Line 6. Then I ended up going to KRK. And at KRK, it was part of the Stanton Group, Stanton Magnetics, you know, and they owned Sermon Vega. And KRK was actually losing money when I got to work there. And so they just left me alone. And Larry Altman, who was the head engineer, and Keith Clowder, who founded the company, they just ignored us because they had bigger problems to deal with as a group, as executive management. So we redid the V-series monitors, mm-hmm. and we invented the rocket-powered
monitors. I still have my rockets. They're great.
You know, and I was involved in like just about 100% of the decisions that were made on all that stuff, from how we changed the logo, how we, you know, positioned the product, how we marketed the product, how we priced the product, where we had it made, you know, and, you know, rocket powered and the V series too. By the time those had been out for a year, KRK was the largest studio monitor company in the world. And we had the E8s, E8T, the titanium, mm-hmm. Phenomenal studio monitor.
No, I remember them.
It was ridiculous, you know. And I left there and started a consulting company after I left KRK. I thought, man, you know, without getting sucked into stupid meetings and, you know, pointless misdirections by someone that feels they need to flex their muscles, you know, if I could just focus on what makes a business work,
right,
you know, and then walk away and let those people deal with it, I could probably handle three or four businesses at a time. And so I focused my consulting business at little engineering driven companies where the guys really understood the engineering. They didn't understand sales and marketing, and they could have access to someone that's had world-class experience at it, you mm-hmm. know, and bring that same kind of quality to the sales and marketing as they did to the engineering. And that worked. And one of my first customers was Nick Epifani at Epifani Bass Amps. economic crisis happened. I had other clients I worked with, but the economic crisis happened in 2008. I needed to come in from the cold because the first horse that gets eaten is the consulting horse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
And so I went to go work at JBL Professional. And that's where I met Anthony Fragoso. Mm-hmm. And Anthony and I were involved in product development. And we developed over 26 products, something like that, for JBL Professional, which to date have probably sold $750 million worth of dealer sales.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be over $1 billion at retail. That was in 2008. After the economic crisis started settling down, I wanted to get back into consulting. And I did some work for some people. I can't go into any of the details of it, non-disclosures and what have you. But I saw a hole in the bass amplifier market. I had the wherewithal to put this thing together. I called Michael Pope, who was a client for right. my consulting business, mm-hmm. and said, what are you doing with the preamp? You know, because rack mount preamps for bass players weren't selling. You know, no one's buying amps and preamps anymore. So we worked something out. He's got a partner, David Yates. David Yates does all the hardcore electrical work. Mike, I've dubbed Mike the creator in residence, because that's what he did. He created this EQ this in the preamp. And David is the one who integrates that into this design. David has 72 patents to his name.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible.
That's a huge amount.
But let me ask you, what was lacking as a bass player in the bass amps that you were seeing where you felt you could fulfill? I'm curious what you found lacking.
It was a refinement in what was going on. So for me, having been heavy into the speaker thing between KRK and JBL. Mm-hmm. You know, I know what a good speaker cabinet is, and I know how to make one, and I know the elements that are involved in it. And Anthony and I just clicked. It's like a great, you know, rhythm section, you know. And as an engineering sort of applications engineering guy, I guess that's what you would call me. Mm-hmm. We just clicked, and he, you know, if I would say something to him, he could manifest that in a crossover or a tuning, or he knew, he could understand the vision. And the thing with Trickfish is it's not just the head, and it's not just the cabinets. It's the 1 + 1 = 3, because I view this as a system. And I think that's one of the things that other companies may or may not do. They don't view their rigs as a system that, you know, the electronics integrate with the acoustics. There's a symbiotic relationship between the two. And, you know, what was missing for me was in the, you know, there was this movement towards light end, lightweight speakers that utilize neodymium drivers. It's very convenient, you know. But neodymium, the Chinese did to neodymium what the Saudis did to oil in 1974, and the price of neodymium shot up 800%, you know.
Right.
And so now you're in a situation where it's not affordable. It's come back down. It's about twice what it used to be.
But the Neomag,
it
sound as good as like an all-nickel?
Well, okay.
In your opinion, can you do that?
I wasn't hearing anybody get the low frequency that I was used to. Now, if you go back and, you know, I told you what my rig was back in the 70s. There was a lot of bottom in that rig, man. It was huge, you know. But it was fundamental. It wasn't the octave above. And a lot of Neo cabs, if you're there, somebody's using really good neodymium, like JBL in their concert tour sound systems, because you're flying all that weight from a ceiling, you know, you have mm-hmm. to cut weight. It's dangerous. It's a life safety issue. You know, they had neodymium technology that was second to none, and the quality of the neodymium, you know, neodymium when it gets hot loses its magnetic properties, this Gauss properties, mm-hmm. And therefore it's got less low end. You know, so if you're not using super high quality neodymium, you know, as the speaker heats up, you know, it becomes less efficient. You know, and because at JBL, when it was an interesting thing, when that neo shot through the roof, I was tasked with replacing a bunch of existing SKUs that had neodymium in them with a ferrite ceramic, you know, alternative. Yes, it was going to be heavier, you know. But when Anthony and I started working on that project and we started using these old JBL designs of raw frame drivers and putting them in boxes, we started listening to them going, holy crap, listen to that. It's thick, it's meaty, it's, it really sounds good, you know. So Anthony and I tried to get a 4x10 to be lightweight and still sound good. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I tried lightweight wood. We tried the neodymium drivers. I ended up looking at Anthony and saying, you know, if I want something light and airy, I'll go get a croissant. But this isn't a bass cabinet, you know. And so we put 18 millimeter birch, void free Baltic birch, mm-hmm. in a highly structured cabinet, and we put the ferrite drivers in there, and we use Eminence drivers. Man, you know, it was like you're just moving major air, you know, and it feels like bass. Now, when we voiced the 12 inch models, I voiced those boxes specifically for guys that are playing really super fast. There is a movement out there now where guys aren't necessarily moving a ton of low end, right? And the Fusion Airs you know, even some jazz, just straight ahead jazz guys. You know, they don't need that much bottom end. And portability is a huge factor for them. And we got a great sound out of the 12s that we're using. And in fact, we have a proprietary 12-inch driver that Eminence built for us with a 3-inch voice coil, which no one else has. And that 3-inch voice coil gave us a lot more oomph out of the driver.
Yeah, I think, Tim, you on your website, it says that you use the 212 cabinet with your system.
Yeah, well, I checked out when I met Richard, and which is a long story I won't get into, but when we finally did get together, and I couldn't wait to hear these amps, you know, because on paper and in speaking to him, they sure sounded like great amps. So I go to meet with him and with Anthony and checked out a bunch of cabinets. And when I heard the 2x12 cabinet, that was exactly what I was looking for in an amp, which was something that's not exactly portable. The 2x12 is a pretty hefty cabinet.
It's 60 pounds.
But it's not too heavy. But
a backbreaker.
Yeah, but what I liked about it was it just had that thing that I've been looking for a long time in a bass amp, which was... You know, like you were saying, ability to move air, have some nice low end and super clarity, and then also what Richard was saying is how it works with the Trickfish head.
Yeah,
it's just the combination.
Yeah, the bullhead
1K, and with that superb preamp, and everything just works perfectly. And as a bass player, I mean, it was just there's a whole lineage of things I can go down why it works, but basically it sounds amazing.
Well, go ahead and grab your electric upright sure. You have, because I want to make sure that we hear we're almost
halfway there.
You know, I was just looking at my watch. While he's setting that up, I wanted to ask you a question, Richard, to go from the speaker side to the power section side.
Yep.
Because everybody's gone class D these last couple of years. My question to you was, did you find that there was an area for that to be refined or improved, or is that pretty much everybody's got it? We know how to do it. The interesting part of the circuit is in this new EQ that you've developed.
So Class D amplifiers, a good one, and we're spending the extra money to buy a very good one. And I'm not going to go into who makes it because we reserve the right to change anything at any time.
But there was a way to move up and improve that component. So.
And we worked with the manufacturer of that Class D amp, and you know, used a shoehorn to get some secrets out of them to improve the peak performance, and and this is where David Yates comes in. You know, David can get on the phone and he can speak schematic to their top guy over there, who's a PhD, and they trusted us enough to let us get in there and mess with it. And so the performance levels we're getting out of it are different than everybody else's performance levels.
It's
benign. The amplifier is benign. What you're going to hear right now is, and Tim's going to play, he's got an NS, what model? Do you know what it's called?
I don't know.
It's an electric upright.
Right. You can go ahead and turn it on if you, is the amp on?
No, it's on mute. Nope, you're not on mute.
It's not on.
Are you plugged in?
Yeah.
Now,
he should be on.
Yeah, he should be on.
I'm not even getting it direct. So, but while you're setting that up, I'm going to ask you a question. So the basic philosophy is, and the power stage is a very flat, clean amp, not much distortion, and then you get all of the sound from the EQ and
the
preamp.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that's one of the good things about Class D is you can get a lot of power and it's clean.
There
we go.
It's really soft, right?
Is your volume
I can
up?
Bring it up.
Yeah, I think the battery's probably going on this. That's probably what's happening.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Now, this is an upright bass. This is not like a standard electric bass guitar. So it's a deep, it's a real rich, deep sound.
I have one in my...
A dying battery would also count for a lot of distortion.
Why don't you put a battery in that, and I'll play this acoustic bass. Right
okay,
there.
Now what we're going to... Yeah, we're...
We need to replace a battery.
Well, while he sets up and do that, I can mention a test to everything that he's talking about. Lisa and I had the opportunity once to walk into SWR a number of years ago when he was working there. And the attention to detail that Richard was putting into the speaker development at that time was pretty astounding to me. He was on whatever iteration of speaker that was at that time, and he was like, you feel what I'm trying to get here is like a pillow thing, like a huge pillow just hitting you.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I looked around. I don't remember what it was from the other employees, but it was just the notion of like this had been an ongoing, obsessive, incredible stretch of speakers to reach, and it's obvious at that level.
I am obsessive compulsive.
I wouldn't say well, that. You do seem to be blinking a lot, which is weird. But the attention to detail was phenomenal. I know that's what's been brought to Trickfish.
I have to count to 12 before I start playing. So
okay, no, that's fine. I just want to mention real quick that the speaker cabinet he's bringing in, it's a 10-inch with a little tweeter on it.
Well, it's a silk dome tweeter. So this is the new. I've got a prototype here of a new cabinet. I told Jeff I'd give him an exclusive. This is the first time we're going to officially announce that this will be a product available.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the part number is a smallmouth one, a 10, a SM110. It was the idea for it came from a guy down in Texas, Ryan Owens. And he even gave us a name for it, in keeping with our fish theme. It's called the Perch. Mm-hmm. And it will. It's going to have a little device that you can point this up at you. And it was designed for acoustic bassists primarily. But it's an awesome speaker cabinet for anybody that plays any kind of an acoustic instrument. Anthony and I took what we learned at JBL doing full range, what I've learned doing bass cabinets, and what I learned about doing studio monitors. And Anthony knows about doing studio monitors as well. This is like a giant studio monitor, a high-power studio mm-hmm. monitor. And the bullhead is so benign that until you engage the EQ, where everything is on flat right now, we're simply passing a signal through the power amp into this speaker. And I've got this. Tell me about this bass real quick.
This is a Boulder Creek. This is a Koa four-string bass. I have D'Addario strings on this. And the preamp that's on here is flat. So here he's plugged into the amp, and it's pretty full. I mean, even direct, it's got a lot of tone and character. Go ahead and play it. Now, while he's playing, I'm going to take out the microphone and just this is the bullhead direct. So you can hear there's a lot of low end, there's plenty of low end and a lot of headroom in the amp. Okay, now I'm gonna bring down the direct and I'm gonna play the speaker. So it's got a lot of range, and I'm using my Audio Technica 2035, and it's about a foot and a half to 2 feet away from the cabinet. And it's a little tiny cabinet, which is great for coding around. Now I'm gonna mix both of them together. And you can hear. So, and that's flat. Everything's flat. The guitar and the amp. And it's just way nice tone. It just has a nice sound. And it's warm. You can say that amp sound is kind of warm. He's growling now. He's digging.
Growling, but it's also not overly thumpy. And that's the thing about it. It's not. The whole idea of this particular speaker is not to overemphasize those frequencies that typically get overemphasized with
right.
acoustic bass, whether you know the standard stand-up bass or one that he has there. It's just a beautiful natural
right.
sound here.
Yeah, now, a really nice focus, which is nice. That's what
right.
you always want. Is a good
now,
focus.
Before we go to the upright, let's go ahead and unplug this and let's try Lisa's bass. She brought the.
So I want to try one thing with
okay.
this bass. Now, typically, the way that this preamp is designed, it's designed like the channel strip of a console. And as opposed to what you would do with most typical bass amps is going up and adding frequencies, with this one, it works best when you cut. So I'm just going to go over and cut a little low mid and a little high mid. There's selectable center frequency points, I'm going to use the higher of the two on those things. So, and here it is with those frequencies cut.
Really nice fundamental with some of the thump taken out, but you can really hear the note. It's lovely.
And you don't get the stringy sound. Now put it back.
Okay, and that's the two mids.
Yep.
Thump is back.
It's great, because like you can actually... If you have a lot of mid-range in your mix and playing with a band, you can dial that out, and it gives you the low end and a little articulation, and you cut through. That's really good.
Okay, I'm going to mute this. Let's plug in the upright.
Yeah.
Because I want to show also to the...
We're going to show her bass, and I think that's, you know... This from you. You certainly, for the guys that are doubling Tim, wouldn't you say that this is going to be a... you got enough cable?
Yeah. Okay, this is the upright. And I want him to show, he brought a bow too, so I want to show fingers and bow so you can hear the difference. Okay.
Is it working?
No, I got it muted. Okay.
Huh.
You got another dead battery?
It's 9 volts, so it's 18 volts. I don't know what's happening. I am sorry that this is happening, guys.
It worked perfectly.
We just heard it before.
I know. Yeah. I don't know what happened.
Are you sure? Is the cord good?
Yeah, it's in there.
No, the cords.
All right, well, let's go to Lisa's bass then. Sorry about that.
Hey, nabbit.
Yeah. Well, can I just comment on it then at least? While we're plugging her in.
You know what, Tim? Play this.
I'll play a little bit. One of the good things about this little cabinet, I don't know if you can hear me on mic, but is that what Richard was saying about guys, people who double, and you know, it's even though it's extremely portable, it has some really nice low end, and in the right club atmosphere or recording.
Now this is when we had Michael Tobias on, Lisa brought this bass. This is a 5-string, a bolt on. And this bass, when we showed it on the show at that time, it's got a great tonality and great overtone. So it'll be a perfect example, perfect for this amp.
Is this a mess for him?
Yeah. There you go. No, this is treble. These are volumes. So these are flat. That's flat. Everything's flat.
But I was saying about the little cabinet, it actually works really well as a doubling. You can play electric through it, which I'm playing right now. It's very articulate, as is this bass. This is really nice, this bass.
And again, that's all flat right now. We're not boosting or cutting anything.
Why don't you show the same thing that you did when you
played? Okay, so is the bass flat?
Yes.
That's both pickups, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Now he's going to do the same thing he did with the acoustic. He's going to cut back.
Ooh. And it warms it up without losing the punch. And, you know, now if you were to go to the back pickup, what you would find is that you still have a lot of warmth.
It gives it sounds to me like that tube warmth that I like of a tube amp.
That
I use a basement.
Okay, so you were asking me what I wasn't hearing in amps. It's that. It's the Class D. It's this 6-pound amp that actually can sound tubey, you know, and warm, and give you an authentic old school sound, can give you a ridiculously modern sound, and at the same time, do it in a way that is easy to get to, simple to understand. The user interface of the Bullhead was designed specifically with these big giant knobs, and they're milled aluminum knobs, so they have a lot of weight to them. So when you turn them, you get that feeling of precision, you know. But in the middle of a gig, bass players know this, when you have that quarter note rest and you're thinking about what can I possibly do to make this thing sound better, You know, you can reach over there in that quarter note, grab it, and not worry about hitting any other knobs because right. they're so tiny. You know, and now you've got, you know, that's what this is. This is about practical application of super high end technology in its simplest, most agreeable way. So there's no built-in compressors, there's no built-in octavers or distortion devices or any crazy stuff. We spent all the money on very high-end op amps, mm-hmm. you know. High-end, those. There's a couple of electrolytic capacitors in there. They're very expensive, each one of them, you know. There's two of them in there. Here's something you can Google. Electrophorus electricus. Mm-hmm. That's what we've named them. It's written right on the circuit board. nice. You have a simple effects loop on the back. That's either pre or post. And you have a ground lift on it. You have a tuner out. And you have a mute switch, so you can use a standard latching switch. Hosa makes them. You can buy them for $5.
Right. But the amp, obviously one of the main key features is that EQ circuit that you have in there in that preamp. But it's a simple system.
Yeah.
And then you add your effects as you want through the effects loop. So it's no frills. It's basically just a bare bones amp with a killer preamp in it.
And a killer power amp in it.
Yeah.
And killer electrical components. Because we didn't want to start cutting price, you know, cutting costs on other things in order to add superfluous stuff.
Right.
So
we're out of time. I told you this would go by fast. We're done. Means you guys have to come back because we really didn't get the chance to really do a lot with I'd like to explore that whole the EQ system, and we definitely I want to hear this upright. We heard it before the show, and we'll do it again because you got to hear this thing. It's amazing. Anyway,
we can also interject briefly that when he did do this at NAMM, downstairs in that little corner of the hall was like a who's who of bass players. Everybody was coming down
to check this
stuff out. So the word is out, and everybody needs to go check out these amps.
Yeah, I want you to go down to www.trickfishamps.com and check out what they're doing here. These cabinets, I mean, you can get anything you want. I mean, with this new 10-inch, you got a little studio rig that's good, and it's got plenty of power. He's not cranking this. He's not even pushing the speaker. I mean, I'm using the preamp direct to give you a little more volume because of the limitations in the studio. But this thing this got plenty of power. This thing can get loud, this little 10.
Oh, yeah. We cranked it up to about 96 dB.
Yeah.
Okay? Before it really started, pleading for mercy.
And that was on the that was on a 5-string.
That right. was on a 5-string. Yeah.
On the low B. Oh.
Now, I want to also mention www.timlanders.com. That's your site.
Right.
And Carbe.
www.carbeanduran.com as well as www.incendioband.com.
And I just want to mention real quick, they got a new album coming out on the 22nd, and which is very cool. I've heard some of it already. JP will be back with me next week demoing something else, and then they're going to be on the 21st, just before the release of the album.
Tim's got a new record in the works, and tell him who you are.
Yeah, I've already got a good lineup started. I have Vinny Colaiuta, Carlos Rios, Gannon Arnold, Nate Wood, and others. So
when do you think it's going to be out?
That'll be out at the end of the summer.
Did they all
end
of the summer?
And then let's get you back on. Let's bring this amp and your bass, and we'll go through your album, but then we can... It's an excuse to bring you guys back.
Sure, absolutely. So,
and pictures of the Boston House.
Yes.
You want to see
Oh, yeah, that place is famous.
All right, everybody.
Thank you, Jeff.
It's time to go. Sorry, we ran late, but there's just too much here, too much info, and we definitely have to get you back. I want to thank all you guys. It's just great to have you here. We'll see everybody next week. Everybody have a great week and a great weekend.
Bye.